Welcome to
BirdWorld.com. A podcast for those involved in designing, developing, and running websites. This is what everybody waits for. Hello and welcome to the 101st episode of BoagWorld.com, the podcast for those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. So, it's show 101 then, Marcus.
Yeah, there's kind of something sinister about that. We should be putting all our things we don't like in here, room 101.
But let's face it, if I started doing that, it would dominate the whole show, wouldn't it? We'd be going for hours. Things I don't like.
Yeah, what is it you've got on the BoagWorld site about you? Makes me giggle every time I read it. Something along the lines of you're really keen about web design and grumpy about everything else.
Yeah, which I think is probably a fair statement, really. I think that sums up me beautifully.
Yeah.
So, there we go. I guess the first thing to say is, I'm going away on holiday. I don't care
about
anything else. So, there we go. Yes, no, I am away for the next 2 weeks. Hurrah!
Yeah.
And so, no show next week, no show the week after. So when does that work out? We've got a show the week beginning the... So we'll, next show will be the 27th of November.
My sister's birthday.
Well, there you go.
My eldest birthday.
Yeah, are you a middle child by any chance?
Come on, no chance. You should know me better than that.
Wow.
I'm the baby.
You're the baby. Oh, the spoilt one, of course, yeah. But then I can talk. I'm an only child, and I think that really shows as well.
No comment.
So on this week's show, I'm finally getting around to looking at the subject of intranets, which I've been promising to do for ages and ages and ages and ages and never actually done. So we're gonna just kick off with that this week. We're not going to be able to cover the whole of intranet design all in 1 week, but we can just look at a little slither of the world that is intranets, and mainly me being grumpy as well, which is quite good, and saying stupid things that people say about intranets aren't true. So we're going to do that. Marcus, what about you?
I'm talking about rates again.
Hang on a minute. Haven't you only just spoken about this?
Not only just. That's a bit unfair. I thought to myself, I wrote a little piece for today's show, and I thought, I might have covered this before. So I look back, and in show 70 or 80 something, I did talk about it. But this goes into a bit more detail and talks about different rates for different roles and that kind of thing. So this is part two, I suppose.
Part two. And then the main chunk of our show actually is going to be taken up with an interview I did with Andy Budd, where we discussed things like getting design sign-off and working with difficult clients and that kind of stuff. So... And it's a half-hour interview, and it's got some really good stuff on it. And that will be later in the show. But before we do all of that, I guess, as tradition dictates, we should start with the news.
BoagWorld.com.
So the big news this week is without a doubt the launch of Open Social, which is a new way for developers to build kind of widgets and applications for a number of the high-profile social networks that are around at the moment. It's a really good lineup that they've got on board of people. The thing seems to be driven primarily by Google, but they've got MySpace involved, LinkedIn, and many, many more. And if you go to the show notes, you can see the complete list there. It's a really impressive list of partners, and I'm looking forward to how exactly this is going to work. Fundamentally, it's an API. But it's an API that allows you not only just to get data out, but also to put content in. So it's exciting news for anybody that's interested in delivering content to existing social networks, as basically it's going to mean that instead of having to recode your application for each of the sites you deliver to, you can deliver to them all in one go, if that makes sense. So traditionally speaking, developers have just kind of focused on a single big name, like, say, Facebook to build applications for, because it was just prohibitively expensive to build little applications for all of them. Now, developers can build once for all on every social networking site out there, or at least a big chunk of them. And what's even more interesting is that you can build these little applications and content delivery mechanisms and stuff using nothing more than HTML and JavaScript. So unlike building an application for Facebook, it looks like coding for Open Social is going to be extremely easy. Now, it doesn't mean that everybody is happy with the current arrangement. The development community have been kind of trying to get their head around exactly what this means and what exactly Open Social does. For example, Jeremy Keith isn't particularly happy with it because he doesn't feel that it really goes far enough and solve the problem of users having to re-enter personal information and their list of friends on every single one of these social networking sites that you come across. So, and that's a fair point, to be honest. But also, just in the last few minutes, as I was reading my RSS feed before we kicked off today's show, I noticed that already people are hacking Open Social and getting all kinds of information they shouldn't be able to get using it. So obviously there's a little bit more work to do there as well, which is kind of scary.
So is this kind of, I take it Facebook's not on the list of applications of services that you can develop for. So is this an attempt to sideline Facebook?
Oh, very much so, yeah. They're definitely looking for ways to kind of push Facebook out and, you know, because Facebook have really grown because of this API that they've got and have attracted so much attention because of it. And there's so many applications and so many cool things being built that, yeah, this is a definite attempt to sideline them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the next thing that I wanted to mention is an excellent post I came across from Mark Bolton this week, looking at how designers engage with content. And he kind of comes from the angle of typography, and he's talking about a presentation that he gave a while back. But the argument that he's putting forward is a lot more than just typefaces and typography. It's a much broader audience about much broader point about how we kind of engage with the content as we develop websites.
Don't engage with content as we develop websites.
Exactly. And that's really his fundamental point. You know, how often do we really engage with the content we get from websites as we design them? You know, does the content inform our design? Or are we really just building, a list of templates that then get populated? So it's really thinking in a different way and starting to think as, say, art directors do when they really begin to interact with the content. You know, you see this all the time in kind of traditional advertising, you know, in traditional ad campaigns. The design and the content kind of work hand in hand together. Design reinforces the message and the message informs the design. And although we see this on things like TV commercials, billboard ads and other marketing campaigns, we rarely see it on the web, which seems absurd. And what quite excited me about this article is that in many ways, we've kind of cracked the technical challenges of building with the web now. You know, we've got best practice for coding, accessibility and usability. We know how to make our sites available to the widest possible audience and usable by all. We know how to do that stuff. But are we really engaging with our users? You know, how are we kind of interacting with them on an emotional level? And I think that's going to be our next big challenge. And I think we're going to see art direction coming majorly to the web. So check out that article from Mark. He also refers to some stuff that Zeldman's been talking about on the subject as well. So there's some really interesting things there.
You've got some fundamental problems, though, with web content, with web content driving the design, because it changes so much. I agree and I don't agree on this. Some website content, yes, you feel like they missed a trick and they could have designed it to fit with the content a lot better. But obviously, if someone's changing content daily via a CMS, then obviously what the content was a year ago, it could be completely different to what it is now. I suppose it's like, say, a book or a magazine. A book would be a better example of what I'm trying to say here. The content of a book doesn't, you know, that doesn't drive the design of the book so much. Some do, but do you see what I mean? When it's more informational rather than presentational, the content, it's harder for it to drive one the other, one or the other.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll. I'm not saying it applies in all situations, but I think it needs to apply in more situations than it is at the moment. Yeah. You know, how often do we start the design process before we've got any idea of what the content on the site's going to be? You know, even at the kind of most fundamental level, you know, you're often forced into design far too early before you've got a kind of clear idea, really, of what the content on the site's going to be. So that's all I'm saying.
Yep.
So the final news story I wanted to touch on today is another great list from the guys over at Smashing Magazine. This time it's a list of the kind of top online calendars and date pickers. I don't know about you, but I spend a lot of my time working with dates for various reasons. You know, some of our clients want, you know, date-specific stuff on their website, like events or blog posts. And it is common to want to give users the ability to search by date or to access, you know, calendars of events and that kind of stuff. So this post from Smashing Magazine offers a plethora of date-related tools, from kind of online calendars that you can embed in your website to date pickers for those that want to avoid the differences in date formatting. So instead of, you know, when it gives you a box, enter the date here, well, you know, do I enter it day, month, year, which is kind of European style, or do I do the American style of month, day, year, you know, and or do you avoid that completely by having a little pop-up calendar thing? So there's some great tools there. Definitely worth checking them out. And I'll put a link in the show notes as normal, which is at boagworld.com/podcast/show101. Okay, so I think that wraps up the news. We're only going to do three stories today because I want to give ample time to play all of Andy Budd's interview. So let's rattle on and move to Marcus's segment of the show. So go on then, Marcus, how are you going to do this in a totally new and exciting way that doesn't sound like you're just rehashing the content you did previously?
I could either sing it or do it in German. How about that?
Yeah, do it in German. Go on, I want to hear that. You know, we get a lot of German listeners as well, so they'll know whether you're just making it up.
I'm not even going to try, because I'd sound like Jonathan Ross, and he's embarrassing when he does it. I realised the other day with my son, who's taking German, as both my daughter as well, I know no German at all, zero. I mean, I can do a bit of French because I did French at school, but I didn't study German. I know nothing. It's just like it could be Russian, Chinese, whatever. So apologies, our German listeners. I'm a German dimmy. I've lost the plot completely. Right, rates. Doing it differently. Yeah. As ever, I kind of start writing these articles about pricing and things like that and realise that it's quite tricky and I've got to be a bit careful. So I'm not going to talk about what Headscape charges. No, because it might change. And then people can come back and say, you said on show blah, 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 blah. But anyway.
Well, why don't we overestimate it? Well, let's double our rates. Yes, and then we look like we're doing everybody a favour when they come to work with us.
Yes, at least. And Paul's, we're £1 million a day, and Paul's £1 million an hour.
I'm glad you realise that I'm worth twice, well, not twice, considerably
yes, you
more.
You do a 2-hour day, do you, Paul?
Yeah, if I can get away with it.
Bring down the shops. Bye.
Bye.
Anyway, so I'm going to look at some survey figures. A survey that e-consultancy did a couple of years back, which seemed to be reasonably fair, but they certainly compared well with our rates at the time. We've moved things up a bit, as I imagine most people have, but they're pretty good. And they also look at the different services, and I'm also going to talk about when and how you should go about raising your rates. This topic obviously is of interest to both clients looking for an agency as well as agencies and freelancers wanting to know what everybody else charges, because we all want to know if we're competitive. So to save myself talking about this from both angles and probably confusing everyone, I'm just going to concentrate on this from an agency point of view, because I work for an agency. But it's easy enough to switch things around. As ever, I'm rambling on. First kind of heading I've put down here is you get what you pay for. I mean, it's an obvious thing. But so using my favourite car analogy, are you offering a Bentley, a BMW, a Ford, or a Lada? or similar. I guess the point I'm making is don't overrun, undersell yourself. Recognize what you can offer and go hard for that particular market. Ask yourself, have you got thousands of happy clients being serviced by 100 staff in marble-clad offices in central London? No. Or are you you and your mate who just left uni and you're kicking off your business in your dad's garage? Even though you might be the most talented designers, developers in the world, the last example I just gave, it really doesn't matter one jot. No big spending client is going to go for you. That's a fact of life. Move on, accept it and move on. So if you are looking, if you think to yourself, right, we've got this, we are super talented, and we should be charging top dollar, you need to ask yourself the following, or you need to show the following when you're pitching for work. Have you got a relevant and very high quality portfolio and also a fairly long a long list of clients as well? Can you show reliability and flexibility, i.e., what I mean by that is, can you show that you've delivered on time to budget regularly, and can you show that you can pick the project up very quickly and deliver it very quickly? And it takes a lot of staff usually to be able to do that. Do you offer a wide range of services, i.e., is it, are you, I suppose this is maybe less important. You could potentially charge a very high rate if you're a specialist in one very specific area, but I think, well, if you're not, then you need to offer everything webby, if you like. And you also need to show innovation, that you're innovative, Paul. or at least that you keep up with innovation. You might not actually be innovative yourself, but you make sure that you're keeping up with whatever's happening within the web world. So let's get down to the nitty-gritty. What do people actually charge? As I said earlier, right here, right now, I really don't know, apart from what we charge. But I have got details of a UK survey carried out a couple of years back, and I guess with a bit of an uplift, I guess they're still relevant. So these are the daily charge-out averages across all the agencies that submitted. So that's from literally from one-man bands up to 100-strong marble-clad London agencies. Director or partner was, this is the average, remember, $750 a day. These are all daily charges. And I think they kind of varied between $500 a day and $1,200 a day. So there's a fairly wide, you know, there's a very low and a very high point on these. But the average was $750. A consultant, and I think what they mean by this is a kind of business analyst, was $650. Creative lead, which is a kind of pool type person, I suppose, maybe not quite the same because he's a director as well, was $670. Designer was $570. Project manager, $600. Information architect / usability consultant type person was $610. Developer was also $610.
We ought to make this clear. This is a UK survey and those rates are in pounds.
Yep, absolutely. I did say UK survey, didn't I? Yes.
Yes, you did. I'm just emphasising it again. Yes. Because in America, I don't think you can work on the current exchange rate and double those figures. I don't think you'd get away with it.
No, I would imagine they're fairly similar numbers. I'm guessing, but I would think that they're similar in dollars. But I don't know. Maybe our American friends can tell us. But of course, as I've already said, these figures varied greatly even within certain disciplines. The example I've got here is the creative lead rates were as low as 370 and as high as 800. I've just given lots of different rates for different roles. At Headscope, we used to have one flat rate for everything we did and for all the services provided. We felt that this was kind of fairer to our clients because I think it's because there were a lot less of us and it was like one person would do lots of different jobs and it was certainly a lot easier to manage and price projects. But as we've grown, we found that particularly the pressures on Paul, myself and Chris have grown so much that we've had to basically charge more for those particular roles. And obviously Paul is hugely valuable.
Obviously.
The other thing that the survey looked at was regionality. And this particular survey suggests that regional price differences are pretty much London and everywhere else.
Yeah.
But interestingly, the Southwest came a strong second.
Woohoo!
And we're in the Southwest, of course. Well, I'm not. But
I am.
he is.
I'm proud of it.
But I think large city-based agencies will always be able to charge a premium. I guess it's because just purely because they are nearer. And we recently lost a pitch where it came down to, well, they're nearer us. We had another one early in the summer as well, it makes you grit your teeth a bit. But I suppose to a certain extent, if you're charging for every meeting, if you have to charge for every meeting, then that can add quite a large premium to any price. Whereas if you're literally around the corner, I guess it's the price is considerably less. So it is something you have to take on board. Although, even though city-based agencies can charge a premium, I expect this is less so now because just it's so easy to communicate there are so many different ways of communicating, and people are used to communicating via conference call and email a lot more than they used to be. Mm. For example, we've had a number of clients over the years that we've never met, which is a pretty odd thing, and I don't think there are many other industry sectors that could say that.
And I think they're pretty happy about never having met us, to be honest.
Especially you, Paul.
See, I was thinking about you. Funny, that, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Raising prices. That's the final thing I'm going to look at. I guess this is all that there really is to say on this is that it's a balance. We should all obviously raise our prices to keep up with inflation because it's costing us more to keep our businesses running, so we therefore need to raise our prices to keep up with that and make an equivalent amount of profit. But I guess we should only do so if we think the market's going to take it, because the last thing you want to do is raise your prices and then you don't win any work. And it's also possible that a particular service that was maybe once seen as kind of cutting edge and therefore got a high price tag may later become run-of-the-mill, so it's possible that you may need to cut a price for a particular service. I've thought about this. I think over 6 years, we've lifted our prices by about, I had the figure earlier, I think it was 20% over 6 years. So I think that's fairly reasonable. Mm. And we're trying to sort of keep up with inflation and the like. Anyway, there you go. Prices part two.
Oh, thank you very much, Marcus. I can't remember part one, so I couldn't possibly tell you whether you'd copied stuff straight out of it or not. But I'm going to presume that it was original and creative and well done you. Birdworld.com. So I seriously considered not doing a segment this week. You know, I'm going on holiday soon. What's the point, really?
Well, you won't be doing one for the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, but you know, you think, good interview with Andy, why bother? Why, you know, just shove on the interview and I'll take this week off too. Because obviously the podcast is all I actually do. You know, I pretend to do other things, but don't really. But then I got another email through asking if I could talk about intranet development. And I kind of get these on a semi-regular basis. And I thought, all right, I'll get off my ass and I'll do something on it. Now, I have to be honest, I've kind of half been avoiding intranets in a way. And this is partly because I'm not really an expert in the field. Although, let's face it, that doesn't normally stop me talking about something. However, it's also because intranets are such a massive subject and one in which there are all kinds of minefields and common mistakes that people seem to be making all the time. There seems to be like a huge amount of naivety when it comes to running and developing an intranet. So against such a backdrop, I was somewhat unsure about where to begin, really. After thinking about it for a while, I decided to take five of the most common misconceptions that I've come across and see if we can shed some light on why they are wrong. So here we go. Here's the five. Number one, that the intranet is a money pit. And you hear comments like this. The intranet is not important like the website. It doesn't generate a return on investment. And this seems to be a common perception, especially among senior management. Unlike the website, the intranet is perceived as not really being business critical. Instead, it's nothing more than a big hole into which you pour lots of money. The problem is the intranet doesn't typically generate revenue. However, that doesn't mean that it doesn't create a return on investment. The real benefit of an intranet is in productivity gains. And if used correctly, an intranet can dramatically reduce the time it takes to access key information. It can act as an effective method of disseminating information. It can be a great way for managing workflows through an organization, and it can become a key component in improving communication across the company. So it does generate return on investment, but that, but admittedly, that is not in the form of generating revenue. Instead, it's about productivity gains. The next misconception that you often come across is people saying things like, I don't need to worry about accessibility because I know exactly who's using my website and that there aren't disabled people using the website. The perception that you don't need to worry about accessibility on an intranet is just naive, basically. Just because you don't have users with disabilities at this stage doesn't mean you never will in your business. Moreover, accessibility is about a lot more than just the disabled. By building an intranet with accessibility in mind, you can offer up the chance to deliver it to other devices, such as mobiles or whatever else, kiosks maybe, if you've got a factory. There's lots of different situations where accessibility actually is very important for things other than disabled users. Finally, many people who may not be registered as disabled but still have accessibility issues. This is especially true with more elderly members of staff. They might have poor eyesight or arthritis that can affect them from an accessibility point of view. And building your intranet with accessibility in mind can help improve the kind of usability of the site for pretty much everybody. So don't ignore accessibility issues when it comes to your intranet. The next misconception is that you only need to design for, say, I don't know, Internet Explorer 6, because that's what's used across the entire company. And single browser support for your intranet is a risky route to take, and it seems to be one that the majority of intranets do take, and to be honest, one that we've fallen into the trap of doing before in the past as well. Building for the peculiarities of one browser can easily come back to bite you later. A company won't stay with the same browser forever. Even an upgrade from Internet Explorer 6 to 7 could easily break your site. Build your site from a solid base of web standards, and you're going to have the confidence that when it comes to changing your browser in the future, it's going to have a minimal impact. The other advantage of this approach, of course, is that it's entirely possible to start opening up parts of your intranet to suppliers, even if you do not share the same IT infrastructure as them. You know, so they might be running Firefox. There's no problem with them using elements of your intranet. The next one that I wanted to mention is about employee motivation, because there's this kind of preconception that it's not like a website. People are required to use the intranet as part of their job, so there's not the same need to make it sticky, maybe. It is true that people are expected to use the intranet as part of their job. However, theory and reality are very different things. I've seen many intranets effectively, abandoned, basically, because they're just too difficult to use. And it's quicker to use another method, such as picking up the telephone or sending an email, to get hold of the information that you require. It might be on the intranet, but if it's not easy to find and it's difficult to navigate to, then it's quicker just to email or pick up the phone. An intranet will only succeed if it has the right information, if it's easy to use, and if it's engaging. Some of the most successful intranets are those that work hard to be as sticky as any website would be. They add things like social features as a good way of getting people involved in the site, as well as making sure that the site has the right killer applications. However, most importantly, you need to ensure that your site is easy to use and people can quickly find the content that they require. Okay, the final misconception that I just wanted to mention to wrap up this segment is the idea that everybody can add and maintain content to your website, and as a result, you don't really need a webmaster. It's a kind of, in a utopian world, an intranet shouldn't need a webmaster. It shouldn't need somebody to look after the content. Each employee should be able to maintain their own information on the system and add anything that's pertinent and relevant. However, the reality is it doesn't happen like that. Some people are just too busy to mess around with this intranet thing, while others load far too much kind of erroneous information that really don't need to be on the intranet at all. So the intranet ends up being full up with loads of crap and without actually, the key content that they need, because those key people don't have the time to put up the content. An intranet needs a web manager in the same way as a website does. It needs somebody to be the guardian for the content and ensure that the right stuff goes online and is organized in a logical manner. So there you go. That's my five misconceptions about the intranet. And intranets are a huge subject and one that I promise to return to at some point in the future. And maybe look at some more specific problems that are faced by intranet designers. Hopefully these few misconceptions have helped challenge your thinking a little bit and how you approach and design and build intranets. And although,
maybe we could combine intranets with information architecture, because we did a big project for an English organisation a year or two ago.
Yeah.
We looked at, we did a lot of information architecture and design work on their intranet.
Well, there you go. That's a subject you can do, Marcus, being the information architecture guy.
I can do that.
Okay. Sold. Budworld.com. Joining me today is Andy Budd. Hello again, Andy.
Hi, Paul. How are you doing?
Not too bad. It's been a little while since I've had you on BOAG World, I think.
I think it's been a couple of years now. I think it was Deconstruct 2006 was the last time I remember chatting to you.
Unbelievable. I've spoken to you since then on the .NET podcast, mine. So, you know, we're keeping in touch.
Yeah, and also just hanging out together, you know, doing you know, things.
I try and obviously avoid you, because whenever I meet you, you seem to be horribly rude to me, but I will forgive you for that.
Oh, Paul, that's not true. That's not true.
Yeah, but I want to paint you in a bad light and get a bit of sympathy for myself.
Oh, okay. That's your tactic, actually, isn't it?
Yeah.
I also heard that you try and play dumb. So, you know, everybody else comes across as smart and you get the sympathy vote.
You've been listening to the Risington podcast, haven't you?
I have, indeed. I'm not sure I buy that, but, you know, it sounds good.
You think I'm just naturally dumb.
So what was the first question?
Okay, the first question. Now, what we're going to talk about today with Andy is just looking at maybe processes. You know, when you run a web design company, how do you go about dealing with getting things like design sign-off? And this was something that came up quite a lot in the 100th episode that we recorded a little while back. Is also something we vaguely talked about, the idea of running a web design company on the .NET podcast recently. But I kind of wanted to kind of home in more on design, because design is a hugely subjective area, and getting design sign-off is quite a challenging process. So, Andy, let's kick off by... just if you could give us a rough sketch about how ClearLeft go through the design process. What are the steps that you go through?
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of interesting because it has changed, you know, a small amount anyway, from when we started to what we're doing now. I guess one of the main differences from what we do to what a lot of agencies do is we generally only present a single design concept. Mm-hmm. It's very common, particularly for companies that come more out of a print background, to do this whole idea of, like, we'll show three design concepts to a client. I think that partly comes from a desire of print design companies to sort of make a bit more money. So rather than just showing one design, they do three designs and you know, let the client pick. I've always found that this is a bit of an odd way of doing things because, well, first of all, I don't think you're really giving your client good value, because what you're ending up doing is you're doing three times the amount of work, and the client only gets a third of the value. They only get to pick one of those three designs.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I've found is whenever I've worked at agencies that have taken that process, and I've been the designer developing the designs, invariably what happens is you spend, you know, say you've got a week to produce designs, you spend maybe 3 or 4 days on one design, and it's working really well, and you're happy with it, and it's moving in the right direction. You maybe spend 1 or 2 days on another design, which you're kind of, you know, fine with. If the client picks it, you know, you're happy because it looks nice, and then you'll do something quickly for the last half a day just to kind of fill up the space.
Yeah,
and then you have this horrible situation whereby you know, either the client picks the design which you're least convinced with, or, you know, what more than likely happens is they'll kind of pick elements from each design and create a sort of a bit of a Frankenstein's monster. And I kind of do think that clients come to, you know, professional design consultancies for their, you know, for their design knowledge and their design experience. And I think that from my perspective and from my experience, the design that the designer feels most happy about is probably the design that fits closest to the client's goals, because that's the one they've kind of been spending more time and effort on thinking about. So the first thing we tend to do at Clear Left is only ever show our client an initial design or one design. That doesn't necessarily mean that we'll only create one design. Quite often, you know, for instance, Paul, one of our designers, our lead designer, might create a couple of different versions initially, and you know, we'll have a design review and I'll look at what's going on, and we'll chat about the various pros and cons of the different designs, and he might spin off in another direction. But we tend to show the client what we think is the best bet, rather than you know, something that is half finished or just, you know, something that we don't think is quite right.
I mean that I would agree with that, that the whole principle of if you're showing a client multiple designs, they inevitably pick a little bit from each of them, and that never quite works as well as it sounds. I mean, have you ever tried with multiple designs having more than one designer work on those designs? So you do like one each of three of you or something like that?
Well, again, I think this goes back to giving value to the client, and I don't think... You know, I don't think it makes sense for the client to pay for two or three designers, you know, time and expertise, to give them the opportunity to kind of just pick one. I think, I mean, you know, I think what tends to happen in that sense is design stops become about solving problems and starts to become much more subjective and almost a beauty competition.
Yeah.
So what happens is, rather than the client picking a design or understanding the design from the technical point of view, you know, why you've, you know, what mood you're trying to create, or what feeling or sensation, or how the hierarchy works and how the hierarchy that you've created matches the hierarchy of use that you need to, or use it to sort of flow through. Rather than it being more scientific, it becomes much more subjective, and it becomes much more about, you know, whether the client liked a particular color. You know, they had a particular color on their bedroom wall and they hated it, so, or they loved it, you know, or it's their favorite color. So I think having, again, just having that kind of three design approach makes it much more subjective and much less scientific.
Yeah.
I mean, I do agree that if a client's got lots of money, you know, if you're talking with a big client and, you know, they've got, you know, months and months worth of design budget available, then it does make sense. The kind of clients that sort of, you know, myself and most of my colleagues sort of deal with, you know, they've got reasonable budgets, but they don't have budgets to burn, so they want to see as much value as possible. And the idea of ditching two designs just kind of, you know, seems, it just doesn't, you know, in a sort of environmentally sort of, you know, challenged world that we live in at the moment, where people want to recycle and people want to, you know, see usage. Throwing two designs away always seems a bit kind of wasteful.
I mean, talking about the thing of making the process more scientific and less subjective, I mean, how do you go about encouraging the client to set aside personal preference and focus on, you know, how they should really be judging the design? Sorry, there's a spin-off question there, which is, how should they really be judging the design?
Well, I mean, it is a really difficult question. I think everybody feels that they have a good understanding of what design is. Everyone's got their own personal opinion. Everyone's got their own personal tastes. And so they feel that, you know, everyone feels that they've got an understanding of design. You know, we've all watched Changing Rooms. We all know that a flouncy designer comes along and he's got big cuffs and, you know, paints, you know, crazy colours on the wall and sticks vases all over the place, and that's design. But I think what people actually see is not design, but the manifestation of design. The actual design process is much less creative than people like to think. It's much less throwing bits of colour on the wall and using your creative juices to see what colours and shapes match. It is much more of a process. It's much more of a starting off with a central problem or a central set of problems that you're trying to solve. And then using design techniques, hierarchy, color, weight, positioning to create a design that solves a solution. And again, I mean, it's kind of a bit of a trite comment, but design works within constraints. You know, there's not, you know, if you are to sit down in front of a blank canvas and just create something, that's much more of an artistic endeavor than a design endeavor. Funnily enough, we're having this conversation in the office today, and, you know, a couple of minutes before we had this conversation, and it's much easier for good designers to have constraints, to have content they need to design around, to have an idea of who's going to be using the site. And so just, you know, I think design is much more of a scientific process than a lot of clients give it credit for. As to your sort of first question, how do you get clients to feedback in the right way? It's very, very difficult. I mean, ideally, what I'd like to say is, you know, we sit down with every single client and explain the design process in detail and explain how it all works and stuff. But unfortunately, design is very subjective, and also feedback is very, very difficult to interpret.
Yeah.
You know, if a client comes to you and says, "Oh, I want it more whizzy or more zingy," you know, they're using the vocabulary they have at hand to describe something that they have an idea of in their mind. And our job as designers is to try and understand what it is they're actually trying to say. You know, they're trying to communicate a visual thing or emotional thing with words. And quite often it's not possible. Quite often, you know, you will have to try two or three different approaches before you actually figure out what zingy means. Does zingy mean bright and colorful, or does zingy mean that they want motion? Or and so it's difficult having design discussions with people who aren't trained in using, you know, having design discussions. I mean, frankly, I find it difficult enough sort of having internal design reviews with our designers and trying to describe what's right or what's wrong with the design. So I do, you know, I do really understand from a client's perspective how difficult it is to try and deal with their designers and get their desires or get their senses across. I think we always try and take it back to kind of first principles. We try and encourage our clients not to sort of worry or obsess too much over the details, but to kind of think more on the broad picture.
Yeah.
So not whether you like this particular color or whether you like this particular shape, but you know, what kind of sense or feeling are you trying to have this design communicate? You know, we're doing some work with a sort of an environmental website at the moment, and they really wanted to create a sense or a feeling of nature and openness and warmness, but really avoid the kind of cliches of, you know, let's have pictures of trees and, you know, it all be green and it all be kind of earthy. And so they communicated the sense and the emotion they wanted to get across, and then we obviously translated that and put it into a graphical format. And I think in reality that's what the designer's job is. It's translation, except instead of translating one language, written language, to another, we're translating a written language or an oral language into a visual language. And so it's interesting, but yeah, it's setting the boundaries and saying to people, this is not, you know, we're not asking you to comment on at this stage on the details. We're asking you to comment on the general sense, the layout, or the feeling. And as you move along, you get more and more kind of specific.
I mean, you talk about how sometimes a client uses a different language to describe what they're seeking from a design. So do you ever use things like mood boards or what other sites do you like as a way of kind of getting an idea of their personal tastes? And
yes,
should you be catering for their personal tastes anyway?
It's a fine balance. I mean, yes and no. Ultimately, it's not the client that will be using the website. It's the client's clients or the client's customers.
Mm.
So really, the ultimate goal is to create something that, you know, the client, the customers or the visitors are going to use, the visitors are going to love, and they're going to kind of feel that it's their own. But obviously, you also are dealing with, you know, human emotion, and if a client's paying you money to create a design, you want them to be happy with it as well. Again, it's kind of, you know, it's an interesting challenge. We have, you know, we used to in the past really encourage our clients to go out and have a look at different websites that are out there, and we've actually got a Flickr group of inspiring websites that we can point clients to and say, look, here's some of our favorite websites. Why don't you go and have a look at some of these and, you know, use those as a basis, because it's really useful. Instead of asking people off cold just to describe what they want, to actually let them show you stuff, and they can say, well, I like the typography of this site, or I like the, you know, the color scheme of that site. A lot of designers will actually say, oh, you shouldn't ever show sites. You should all, you know, because then it gets all a bit derivative. But I think, you know, as we're working on the web, it is helpful to show clients similar designs in that same medium.
Mm.
So I think it is useful for us anyway to show client sites. And that's kind of, you know, that's always a good starting point. You know, we like this site because, or we like that site because. Unfortunately, sometimes it backfires, and sometimes, particularly if a client isn't as sort of embedded in the design community as we are, they will pick some sites which they use on a daily basis that don't necessarily sort of show good, you know, good designers as designers might kind of perceive it. And then we have to kind of, you know, work around the edges and maybe show them some ideas of what, you know, what we think they might be thinking about. But the mood boards is a really good point. It's something that we've sort of started using more of recently. And it's a really good kind of, you know, first step. Rather than jumping straight to the design process and possibly, you know, missing the translation, we have started showing clients mood boards. And if some of your listeners don't know what mood boards are, they're essentially a very quick way of explaining a mood or a sense or a feeling or a color scheme on a design without actually doing visual design. So what you do is you might take elements of design that you've seen elsewhere. You might take some interesting photos you've seen on Flickr, and maybe those photos have an interesting color scheme, or maybe they have a particular theme or scent you're trying to get across. Maybe take some navigation elements from one site, or, you know, a t-shirt you particularly like the color scheme from, or a whole bunch of different things. Put them down on a piece of paper. I mean, in the old days, it was a piece of paper in advertising. People would cut out bits from magazines. And these days, we tend to do digital mood boards, which more, you know, graphic art and photos, and present them to the client. And that gives the client a kind of a basis from which they can kind of spin off their opinions. So they can now look at this mood board and say, well, when we said we wanted it clean, we didn't mean we wanted it sort of white. We meant we wanted it sort of, you know, some other, you know, yeah, adjective that kind of, you know, works with clean. And it kind of gives them a discussion point. You know, rather than just sitting around words, you can now look at something physical and tangible. And the good thing is mood boards only need to take an hour or two. And again, we're working with a client at the moment, and we initially created some mood boards for them, and it sparked discussion. And they weren't sure about some of the things that were on the mood board, but some of the things on the mood board they really liked. So we worked up a second iteration, which was even closer to what they kind of wanted. And when we finally sort of got to a level that we felt they, you know, both of us understood what we expected, you know, from a design point of view, then you could move on to the next stage.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite interesting. I think design, from my personal experience, is much about what you do before you sit down, you know, in front of Photoshop or whatever, than it is actually in the actual putting pixels on the page. And I'd be interested in what other kind of things that you perhaps do before you get to the design stage. So you said you do mood boards. What about things like personas, or what business background information do you try and get before you start? Do you ask people to personify their company and describe what kind of person it would be? What, you know, all these different techniques that people use, what do you guys use?
Well, again, that's really interesting. I mean, you're right, the majority of people kind of think design is a visual thing, you know, so, you know, the first thing they think about or expect when they're getting designs is to see some kind of Photoshop comps or some pretty pictures. You know, at Clearlift, we are a user experience design consultancy. And what that essentially means is we kind of do meta design. We don't just do the visual stuff, but we design the systems. And so what we do, you know, from the outset of dealing with our clients, we'll have workshops with them. We'll do, you know, a big discovery period to find out exactly what it is they want, you know, requirements gathering. We'll do research into their users. So quite often we'll go out and we'll interview potential users, their potential kind of market. You know, we've done work in the education sector where we spent a couple of days in schools talking to teachers and pupils and school secretaries to find out how they do their day-to-day work, what kind of, you know, features and functions they would require off a site. Using this kind of information from research, we then might, you know, create personas. And personas are, you know, a great way of kind of capturing a rough kind of sort of demographic, I guess, of users. And it allows you to sort of start thinking in terms of how people will use the site. Because what tends to happen is people just sit down and just, you know, think of the stereotypical user. But each user's got kind of different needs. The nice thing about personas is if you've got your personas fairly accurate, it can then help you kind of work out what features and functionality you need by following on the scenarios. So scenario is, you know, say you're buying shoes, or you're doing a shoe store. A scenario might be that I want to buy a pair of, you know, dress shoes because I'm going to a to a formal function, I need to get some smart shoes to match my suit. And then what you can do is you can sit down and you can plan out, well, on this system, how would I get from the homepage through to the purchasing process? How do you get from A to B to C? Mm. And that kind of helps design the system. The problem with personas is quite often you will do personas and they sit in a drawer. So personas aren't right for every single project. And we've had a couple of experiences recently where we have done personas and we probably shouldn't have done because, the client already had a very good understanding of what they wanted to do. But it's kind of trial and error.
Yeah.
Most of the time we find personas work really, really well. But they do work best when the client doesn't really have a set idea of how their website's going to function. Mm. We do wireframes. I mean, wireframes are a big part of what we do. It's a big part of information architecture and a big part of user experience design. And again, if your listeners aren't aware of what a wireframe is, it's kind of somewhat like a storyboard in movies. So in a movie, rather than just going and filming everything, because celluloid's really expensive, they'll get some artists in to draw out scene by scene, frame by frame almost, how the story's going to progress. And that's a way of planning the shots, planning the locations. And, you can sit down in front of the storyboard and get a real sense of how the movie's going to flow and to work before, you ever need to set up on set. And so we do something very similar with our websites. We create wireframes, which can be on paper, they can be HTML. And it's literally kind of a wireframe, a kind of a rough representation of how the site is going to fit together. And so when it comes to visual design, when it comes to the interface designer isn't working from a blank sheet. They're working from a fairly kind of detailed blueprint, not so much on layout terms, but on content. We need to have this block of content here. This is what's inside this block of content. This is the hierarchy. This is most important. This is less important. And so basically once the client has kind of seen the wireframes and understood how the process is supposed to flow, they've already signed off and they've already agreed to a lot of the design decisions. Whereas more traditional visual designers will try and do all that on a Photoshop document.
Yeah.
And I don't really think you can capture the if you're doing just a fairly flat design or if you're doing a fairly simple brochure website, you can kind of capture that sense maybe in Photoshop documents. But if you're doing something more advanced, if you're doing quite a complicated site that has a lot of interactions, maybe a social software web application site, you can't show all of this stuff in a flat document. So you need to have this kind of click-through process.
Mm. Oh, that's cool. Okay, so one last question before we wrap up. I just wanted to ask about the subject of iterations, because it's something that we're asked quite a lot. And basically what people do or are concerned about is, how many iterations do you go through? When the client comes back to you and says, I want this changing, and then you make that change, and then they want something else changing, and it kind of could go on through this endless cycle. Where do you draw a line? Do you have a contractual arrangement? We'll do three versions of this, or how do you deal with it?
Again, a very interesting question. The way we tend to work at ClearLeft is we tend to sell our services based on time spent rather than, some kind of end point, because the design is very subjective. And as you say, you can't keep going on and on and making changes, because otherwise the project will not only spiral out of control in terms of time, but also in terms of budget and stuff. So what we tend to do with our clients and with our projects is we specify a certain amount of time. We'll spend 20 days on visual design and 20 days on template build or whatever, and we are a little bit flexible, and this kind of almost goes back to something I was talking about on my blog recently about deadlines and stuff. If design takes a couple of days more and templates take a couple of days less, in the end it all kind of balances itself out. But we do kind of track time to make sure that we're on track. We tend to say to clients that we'll offer, say two iterations. Again, sometimes it requires more, sometimes it requires less. And we kind of track the time just to make sure that we're not going vastly over. What we try and do is kind of make the iterations increase in size. So going back to what we were saying before about the mood boards, you can do a mood board really, really quickly. And you can get to a point a lot faster understanding what the client's needs are by giving them a mood board, or a couple of mood boards, a couple of quick little iterations, and you know, you get, you know, significantly further down the line. Something we've been doing recently, which I think is a really interesting idea and seems to be working really well, is this concept of a one-day design concept.
Okay.
And so what we do is, in the olden days, we'd spend like maybe a week coming up with initial design concept, and it was really good, it was really high level, it was really detailed, and we'd give it to the client. And if the client, you know, wasn't sure about various elements, we'd be a little bit kind of, because we spent so much time and effort into the design, would be a little bit more resistant to sort of making changes. Whereas we realized if we just did a quick design iteration that was just one day or 1.5 days, we're much less stuck on the design, because it will be rough, because it will be a bit rough and ready, which means that we're much more flexible and much more happy to sort of make changes and go in different directions. Also, it means that if you are only given a day or a day and a half to do a design, you don't obsess on the details. You get the kind of the broad brushstrokes. You get the feeling and the sense and the layout right. But you don't worry about how the text is aligning or how the icons are placed.
Yeah.
And that gives clients a real instant. First of all, it gives them some instant feedback. You know, rather than the old day where you'd go away and do design, magic would happen, and then a week or 2 weeks later you'd have a completely finished product. You know, it gives clients a bit more of an insight and a bit more input into the process.
Yeah.
They'll see after design, you know, they're getting something that's already started to look like a real project, and they're getting really excited, and they sort of start inputting and feeding back. The difficulty is managing the right kind of feedback and getting the right feedback at the right time, because obviously in this early phase, what we're really wanting our clients' feedback on is just the overall look and feel. Is the layout right? Is it giving the right sense? And not obsess about the details, because we haven't spent any time on the details.
Yeah.
And then we iterate, and you know, once we've got an idea, we'll do another iteration which is more finessed, and then maybe a third iteration which is more finessed.
Okay.
And then normally by that point, because we've gone through a bunch of different steps and we've had kind of client buy-in on the way, by the time it gets to the sort of, you know, the second, third round of iterations, it really is usually just kind of dealing with the details.
Yeah.
The problem is that almost all clients obsess about the details more than they really need to. And it is, you know, it's kind of easy to do. I understand if someone puts a design in front of you and you say, yeah, give me feedback, clients obviously want to go and be really helpful, and they'll jump into the design and say, oh, you know, well, that button's misaligned, or I don't like the orange, maybe it should be a darker color or whatever, and really obsess about the details. And I think at that point, I mean, you know, that's our job to obsess about the details. I think, you know,
yeah,
as designers, we are all obsessives, and we'll sit there and we'll, you know, we'll move things a couple of pixels and you know play around in the color palette to make sure it's exactly right. And so what we've been tending to do is, once we've got the initial direction of the project, once we know that the client likes the overall scheme, we end up, we kind of go ahead and build it, and we don't necessarily, or go ahead and design it, and while we're not necessarily not asking for feedback, we're not necessarily asking for it either. So we present our designs, and if the clients, you know, look at them and say, oh, well, this is wrong and that's wrong, that's fine, we'll go and make the changes. But if the client looks at them, you know, if I think the basic, what I'm trying to say is, if you ask for detailed feedback, you'll get detailed feedback. If you present something to a client, then if there is an issue, they will feedback, and if there isn't, they won't. And I think this has come about from a lot of usability testing. You know, we sit down with test subjects, and if we ask them for opinion, they'll always give us an opinion, trying to be helpful, whether that opinion is something they really think, or if it's something they're just like, oh, well, we've been asked to say something, so we better say something.
Yeah.
And so we've been trying to be a bit more kind of subtle with feedback, and rather asking for a definite cutoff point, a definite sign off, and definite, we now expect a long list of stuff. It's like, here are the designs. If you have anything to say, that's fine. But if you don't, that's great. We'll just get on and implement them.
Yeah, I like that. That's a really good approach. Thank you very much, Andy. That was a really interesting conversation. I think every agency does things in a slightly different way, and it's good to hear the clear left methodology.
Excellent. Well, actually, can I just jump in there and say something? Because I think this is an interesting point, and it is a problematic thing. I don't think a lot of companies have a process, and a lot of companies will, you know, every single project, they will do the same thing time and time and again. And that's good because you know at the start of the project exactly what you're going to do, step one, step two, step three. Mm. The problem is not all projects and not all clients want all of those steps, or all of those steps are necessarily valid for the thing they're trying to do.
Yeah.
So I think what we've learned over time really at ClearLeft, and it's something that we're still learning, I think it's something everybody's still learning, is rather than having a process, have a methodology, have a bunch of tools that you can use on a particular project. So if a certain project requires wireframing, we do wireframing. If it doesn't, drop it. If a certain project needs a mood board, we do a mood board. If a certain project doesn't, we don't do it.
Mm.
And so I think a methodology is the right point here rather than a process, because a methodology keeps you flexible, and a methodology means that you don't get stuck doing the same stuff over and over again.
Excellent. Okay, thank you very much, Andy, and I'm sure we will have you back in at least before the next 2 years are up.
Yay. Well, thanks very much, Paul. It's been delightful.
Bugworld.com.
Okay, so that pretty much wraps up today's show. Thank you so much, Andy, for that interview. Really enjoyable one. Very interesting indeed, and very useful. Kind of helped me personally in my thinking about how we run the design aspects of our projects. You remember a few weeks ago I did a question of the week thing, and I've been putting them at the bottom of the show notes every week, but I haven't necessarily mentioned them every week. And this week I do want to mention it on the show, because I'd like the question for the week to be any tips or techniques you have for smoothing the process of getting design sign-off. So go along to the show notes and add your comments there, because it'd be really good to kind of see how other people go about solving this problem. So yeah, that about wraps up the show. Not around for 2 weeks. Enjoy your rest. And we do have a joke, but it's slightly different approach this week, isn't it, Marcus?
Yeah, Ed's sent us in a recorded joke, so I thought, well, we'll just pop that on the end of the show.
Perished the thought that you would have to do any work, Marcus.
Ooh, you, while you're having a rest over the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's going to be so good. And the best thing is we get back and we'll probably do a couple more weeks, maybe 3 weeks, and then it's Christmas. Hooray! So there we go.
Yeah, yeah, that's a nice thought.
It is, isn't it? Okay, so thanks for listening, and here's Ed's joke.
Hello, this is Ed Ross from Portsmouth with a couple of jokes for the end of the podcast. First, what do web developers do when they go to the Heinz website? View source. And second, what do web developers on 56k modems try to do when going to the Heinz website? Catch up. Thanks. Bye.